Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hi, welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Bob Doomer, your host for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. Today's podcast is being recorded at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. Our topic for today's show is a structural collapse that occurred on July 16th in Hackensack, New Jersey. My guest today, Mike Daly, a lieutenant with the Monroe Township Fire District in New Jersey. Mike's also a rescue specialist on New Jersey Task Force One and founder and managing member for Fire Service Performance Concepts, which is a consulting group that aids fire departments with training development. Also joining us today is Sean Conboy. He's a paramedic at the Englewood and Holy Name Hospital. He's got 19 years in EMS service and is also the medic on New Jersey Task Force One. Sean's also a very active member of the Firehouse Program Committee, which provides behind-the-scenes effort to bring events like Firehouse Expo to the emergency service providers. Mike, Sean, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk a little bit about this collapse that occurred in Hackensack. We'll talk a little bit about the type of incident and how this type of event, you know, really justifies the need and the value of specialized rescue teams, and also touch on incident command. When you have a large-scale incident like this, we have to have some way of managing, you know, multiple resources. Kind of just getting going into it, we'll talk a little bit about the call itself. It originally came in as a water flow alarm, and then obviously things changed quickly. Sean, can you give us a little background on just how it came in and what the initial moments of dispatch might have been like?
From what I was listening to, they were initially dispatched to a water flow alarm at the 300 Prospect Avenue, and en route to the response, they updated it saying they were receiving phone calls that there was a collapse in a parking garage.
Now, with something like that, at the time, were the traditional response teams sent, or did it immediately ramp up to where they were calling for any specialized type of teams?
At initial response, they weren't calling anything extra until they got on the scene, and the deputy got on the scene, and Hackensack has one of the UASI rescues for Northern New Jersey. So he has the equipment there that he can start an operation with. Then he, in turn, made it a mutual aid response to backfill Hackensack. He made a department recall for all members to come back, as many members as he could, and he made a full request for the UASI rescues at first, and after which time, with short order, it became a response request for the USAR team.
Now with that, Mike, a UASI task force, how do they differ from your full-scale state-level task force and teams? What would we be getting in a request for this type of resource?
Well, the UASI departments have a rescue that is fully staffed, well, fully equipped and capable of starting the ball rolling on any type of response like this. Members of these 12 departments came through for the formal training in structural collapse operations, and some have been trained to the technician level, so they can start to mitigate the incident. And if the incident outweighs what they can provide as far as manpower and equipment, then the request for the state team to come out. And the state team comes out with a lot more of the technical search and the logistical support and the medical support that the UASI teams might not be able to provide in the initial incident.
With these teams, is there training between the UASI teams and the state-level team on a regular basis or occasionally?
I believe there's an annual drill for the UASI teams that participate through a full-scale exercise. I believe they just had one in Newark earlier this year, and there was some interaction with New Jersey Task Force One at that time. So there are times where they get together and some comparison notes.
So it's a really good investment of grant funds and resources.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Kind of looking at it, a very positive resource multiplier, plus they can be boots on the ground much sooner than a large operation that has to be activated, brought together, and doing the travel. At this particular incident, Sean, what type of structure actually were we dealing with here? Can you give us a little background in the lay of the land for this particular incident?
The apartment building involved was an 18-story concrete commercial building that was fully occupied, from what they were told, that they had went through to knocked on all the doors to evacuate the building. The parking structure was a three-story parking deck that had like a U-shape to it that wrapped around the building on three levels it went down. And it was attached on the back. There was two buildings. It was a 310 Prospect, which is a mid-rise in the back of the building, not attached to 300 Prospect, but adjoining it, that they share services of the parking garage.
So we're dealing with a relatively large structure and accessibility with all of this garage being below surface grade. It actually adds another whole new dynamic of just getting in and doing your initial recon.
It was definitely difficult for them to get in, you know, to get resources in there. It was tight and tough.
Podcast to him.
With that, as you're, you know, working on your initial arrival, the resources are getting on scene, setting up a command post, starting to set up their base of operations. From the medical side, is there anything specific from your position as a medic with the task force that you folks would be looking at to prepare for an incident like this once you arrive, or even en route?
Well, en route, obviously, if you can find out the information, if there is anybody trapped, if they're confirmed, what their condition is, of what you're going to have to do when you get there. Then once we're on the scene and we were made involved with the pre-op as far as the Andy Pollock, who's a deputy chief with the Hackensack Fire Department, was like the liaison for the task force. He's a logistics guy on the task force, really capable guy. He took the members of the task force once the bosses started to show up to task force leaders and did a 180 with us to show us the building, what was going on, and what was involved in it. So we got a good overview of that. As far as what I'm looking for as a medical team is, besides patients, you know, who may be in need of medical assistance, is where we're going to set up, where the RIT team's going to be, and where we're going to remove these people from, whether the people that are trapped or if any of the rescue workers get hurt in the action of trying to shore this up, if there's any secondary or third collapses that they get hurt on, how we're going to take care of them and how we're going to get them out, which way we're going to go.
Well, you know, and that's a key element of a team that we really don't take a lot of time to speak about. Our medical component, and as you hit on, primarily job one is for the benefit and the protection of our team members.
Right, absolutely.
It's your first and foremost, and then obviously because of the skills you people bring, it's one of the deals where you can also be there to aid the community as an assist to the local EMS responders.
If need be, if it got that bad, we would help the local EMS. But the local EMS and something like this, especially such a large-scale MCI that this potentially was, they had their own staging area. They had, I believe, 10 ambulances and two ALS units assigned to this, along with their communications, so that they could have what they needed, assets, if needed to be moved people, if they did get hurt, that we were moving mass amounts. But our primary care is any and all members of the task force and anybody who's trapped. That's our primary care. But yes, if somebody outside and we were there and they needed a set of hands and there was extra medical people, absolutely we would lend a hand with whatever needed.
Very good. Now, Mike, as you were dispatched, the event had already progressed through various stages of development. Command on scene, obviously identifying the potential or the magnitude of what they're dealing with. At that point, goes from a local first in jurisdiction to the UASI units, the equivalent of a squad responses, to now the team is activated. In New Jersey, you have a very dynamic team, works well together, has got significantly good experience and training background. Once you're activated for an incident of this type, what are the first things you start, you know, putting into play as far as your game plan for response?
Well, the way the task force operates is, in this case, and this was a Northern Jersey response, there are responders that come from the north end of the state. They meet at a staging area that's pre-assigned. In this case, I believe it was the high school in Hackensack where Northern responders met there, met with the forward team, who briefed them, and were able to fall into the incident command structure for Hackensack Fire. And like in any other resource that a chief would have at his disposal, we fall in as a resource under the operations section chief of the structure, the incident command structure. What we would do when we first get to an incident like that is usually hazmat goes in first, clears the area, and then we'll send the structure specialist in with them. The search people might go in behind them once we've determine the area that we can approach after taking a six-sided view of the structure. Then we will deploy the resources where they need to be.
So we're looking at a very involved and at times time-consuming process. When people look at USAR teams, they traditionally through the media get the glimpse of the final phase of a rescue, the victim coming out or something of that nature. The list you gave just now really identifies just the depth of knowledge and talent that a response team in the USAR field brings to the table. One of the things you started with, the HAZMAT members will go in, kind of elaborate a little bit of just what are they doing when they go in there. We're not being called to a HAZMAT incident, so in the general public's eye, why do we have HAZMAT people there?
Well, they're there to confirm that the air quality in the area is safe, that there's no presence of hazardous materials, any gas pockets, broken gas mains, issues where we're going to have to be oxygen deficient. Materials that might be involved that could be off-gassing and providing a less than suitable air situation. And we need to address that first before we can send anybody in behind them to do that. If we can't operate in the area safely, then we just can't operate.
Which, you know, really starts to explain just how broad spectrum a response of a USAR team is.
Yeah, just to elaborate on that. You know, if you compared it to firefighting, and a lot of people try to compare the two because there's a lot of firefighters and emergency responders and EMS on a USAR team. So if you compared it, like firefighting is like hockey. You know, where you get in, it's a fast, dynamically changing event, and you're moving quick, and there's a lot of physical activity involved in it. Where you can take a USAR deployment and compare it kind of like chess, where you have to sit back, take a look at what's going on, and strategically decide what your next move is going to be. And however long it takes to move through that process, that's how long it takes. But, you know, safety being as paramount as it is, you have to sometimes take a back seat and look and say, okay, this is what's happening now, this is what we need to mitigate that, and then we can move on to the next step.
With this, Sean, we're looking at, you know, the potential for injuries and that coming from the medical side of the team. With a collapse, what are the type of injuries you may be anticipating encountering and that your team members will be coming upon?
Obviously, the most important thing we're thinking about, or worst thing is, worst case is a crush syndrome, somebody who's trapped under concrete, their car collapsed on top of them along with the dirt and the pressure that's into their body as far as being trapped in there, and can cause many things. Cardiac dysrhythmias can cause imbalances in their body. So when they release these toxins back into their body, when they release the pressure, they can be dead before we even pull them out of the hole. As hard as the rescue guys work to get them out, once they relieve the pressure, if we don't get in and hopefully start an IV on them and give them sodium bicarb and dextrose, two drugs that we try and give them before we move them to alleviate that crush syndrome, they could be dead before we get them out of the hole. So that's what we're thinking to try and do, is once there's enough access to get a medic in, to start an IV, to get these drugs and the fluids going into them. You know, if there's any additional really fast bandaging to stop any heavy bleeding or something, obviously we address that and then out, get them out of the hole situation as fast as possible.
So actually, you know, our medical component of a team really is a very dynamic group as far as the responsibilities that they're going to face throughout the course of an incident. As you referred, because you are part of the team, you have extended training much further beyond your counterparts in the EMS field related to the collapse environment. You're properly equipped, you're properly trained and knowledgeable of how to work in this environment where a traditional responder who would come on scene may not be as viable of an asset in there. So having your folks right there also brings a lot to the table. Working alongside of our rescue specialists, you can afford that. Obviously, we already spoke on how mission one is the safety and the health of the team members, but also the potential victims have a valuable resource with the EMS component of the team being right there on scene and embedded into the operation.
Absolutely.
With this, we'll just talk a little bit, too, on the type of collapse that took place. You know, we've already referred to it as a three-story. There was some very good video from a local television station's helicopter showing this gaping hole, basically, in the driveway. And then below that, obviously, was the volume of damage. Just kind of, you know, a simple assessment of what can be spoken about, what you guys were faced with when you were, you know, first making entry.
Well, obviously, like that, what's the safety of the structure? Like Mike made a reference, one of the biggest things we have is, besides a full component, is we have the structural engineers that come with us. And, you know, I'm relatively new to the team. I have 2 years on the team. It was my first really big collapse to go to something like that. But you get a profound respect and love for these guys because they are continuously monitoring the conditions of the building, which for me was amazing because there was two or three of them almost at the onset, and they were like, seriously, you know, they UASI guys had transit up, but they don't have the technical aspect of having a structural engineer there to tell him or tell us, you know, at a moment's notice. They see something, they blow a horn, or one of the safety officers assigned to them blows a horn, and we're out of the hole. You know, we're out of there. And they did happen twice that they did do that because it did move, and they told us, you know, get out, and then we reassess what we're going to do, whether it's safe for us to operate in it, you know, whether the rescue guys and the search guys can work and underneath. You know, I mean, I can't imagine how many thousands of pounds of dirt and concrete there were, figuring there was three slabs of concrete that went down on top of these cars, on top of thousands of pounds of dirt that were on top of it. So, you know, a lot goes in, like Mike says, a lot goes into this operation. And it's minute by minute, honestly, it's a minute by minute evaluation. When the rescue bosses are reassessing it on, like, I would say every half hour to hour the most, but the, you know, the technical engineers, they would, you know, minute by minute, they were saying things, or, you know, walking around and making sure it was going on, making it was as safe as possible for all of us to be where we were for the time we were there.
And that's a really good point. I know, having worked with different structural specialists, many of these individuals are in their primary fields of employment, you know, certified engineers. They come from the Corps of Engineers, various backgrounds, but like you said, everything we do also has a cause and effect. If we shore or do any minor activity in an area, it could have an impact on not only that one component, but reaching out beyond that exact footprint that you're working in. So the talents they bring to the table, we're starting to see very quickly how there's so many pieces to an operation, much of which are going on behind the scenes or beyond the vision of, you know, the general population. You know, when you're getting a helicopter feed, you're getting a very good look at the big picture, but you're really not getting hardly any knowledge of just what's happening. Similar to a structure fire, you know, the media can show us flames coming out of the windows, but they really can't visually or verbally articulate just what's happening behind the door of that home when the teams enter. With this, Mike, once we do get our structure specialists there, and we've had a chance to, you know, start our initial phases of evaluation from the team, getting together with already on scene resources. What's kind of the process that you guys traditionally would take, or the path to get the team up and moving?
Well, the big question is where to start. And once we've determined the areas are safe that we can operate in, we then send the search component in, made up with canine. Special high-tech cameras. We will they will confirm locations with multiple hits from the dogs. They'll do specific void searches with the cameras, and once they've identified an area where the probability is there, we'll move our resources there and start making our way through it. In some cases it's shoring, in some cases it's breaching, in some cases it's moving. It all depends on the situation. In this event, there was a lot of shoring, there was a lot of vertical shoring. There was a lot of cribbing, 6x cribbing, and there was some tunneling. So, and at one point, early in the event, the focus went from coming in from the parking deck to going from the top of the collapse. At one point, some of the decision makers thought it would have been a better idea to go through the top, so they kind of took a two-prong attack at that point.
And, you know, by having that Plan B, Plan C, and various different options already being developed at the command level, it really helps impart the ability of the team to be adaptive to the situations they come upon. What we initially start with isn't always going to be the final activity that we, you know, we utilize to fulfill our objectives. When you change plans like that, does one area stop, or do we at times have multiple operations going on at the same time?
We usually have multiple operations going on at the same time. There's never like a pause where you'll stop to an extent. There'll always be something happening. You might have to reassess your location as far as stability and if it's a safe place to be, but for the most part, there's always something going on.
You know, and with this, we have our local First In resources, our New Jersey UASI squads, and then the team coming in. The interface and the working together with one another, does that really help as far as like a resource multiplier where we're gaining, you know, trained and functional technicians?
Well, I believe it is. I think anytime you can get boots on the ground a lot faster that way with some highly skilled, trained, competent people, it's only going to benefit us as responders and plus the public. It was a great initiative to get the grant money. It was a great idea to start the training on the departments. I understand the process is continuing. It's going down to South Jersey now. And there's getting some funding to begin to do that down in the south end of the state. It's really going to benefit the service in general, have all those resources that we can rely on as well.
Excellent. And Sean, when we have this many people working in some very tight and challenging and hazardous conditions, what's the fatigue factor, looking at it from, you know, the background from the medical side, when you have individuals working under these extreme conditions, are there certain signs you look for, like a little tell as if you were in a poker game that you need to be aware of and in somebody's capability?
I do as a medic personally. Is I interact with the members of the team, so you get to know them. But you watch how they're working. I mean, if you see somebody, the guys that the rescue guys that are on this team that are working, like I'm sure most rescue teams are, they get in there and they work and they don't stop. But when you see somebody that's has to walk a step aside, you see somebody in conditions like this because it was hot and it was warm downstairs and it was humid, they were moving air down there, which was good. But still, after a while, you see somebody that they stop sweating and they're not sweating, okay? You know, is you're constantly watching for that kind of thing. And we had, like, brought in coolers of water downstairs with ice and then Gatorade, you know, and as... I mean, you could call it being a mother hen, whatever it is, as guys would step away to either get a tool or to get a piece of shoring or to get a strut or whatever it was, you know, they would be handed by myself or the nurse that was with me a bottle of water or a glass of Gatorade on a pretty regular basis so that we continued to watch and hydrate them. And if something, you know, got worse or somebody went down, which on this case, one fireman on the UASI team actually got real dizzy and woozy and actually, you know, went down to his knees. He got pulled out and was evaluated, you know, and was just put in like a 20-minute timeout so that he could, you know, recoup himself because he, you know, hadn't drank in much. He was in there before we were there and still working when we got there, and then had a little bit of heat exhaustion issue that we addressed once we got down there.
So, you know, once again, having that big picture dynamic of the team response, it really pays dividends. Most rescuers, you know, fall into the theoretical type A personality category where they want to work hard, they work hard, and the only time they take a break is when they're literally ordered to take a break.
Right.
Having somebody there keeping an eye out for them, I think is very important. Technologies have changed. We have different tools available to us. I know in the team where I come from, we're looking at different types of cooling vests that are more body heat activated than the traditional popsicle style where you
right.
freeze up a bunch of tubes, yep. put them in, shock the core because we put the vest on prior to doing any work, so the core really doesn't need cooling. So we're almost creating a negative health environment. So the technology's out there, both in our tools for breaking rocks and search cameras have evolved, but fortunately so have the tools to help take care of our most valuable resource, the rescuer themselves. And
absolutely. You know, most important resource.
Absolutely.
Yes. You know, and with the system you have, no matter how much resource multiplying you do, you still have the last one of everything, be it a carabine or a hammer or a rescue technician. If you've used up the last one, the mission's going to come to a halt or to a significantly slower pace. Through this, there were various different reports that came out across the media. The big thing this incident had with it when it was all said and done was zero fatalities, which is what we hope for. Unfortunately, when we're first going into these events, we have to go with the information we're getting. You try to vet it and get as much credibility to it as you can, but we still have to move forward if the conditions indicate it. Mike, you talked about they started doing tunneling and different types of maneuvers. What are some of the different types of shoring systems they chose to use in this event?
A lot of vertical shoring, a lot of cribbing, a lot of debris removal, and shoring as they went. It's pretty much how we operate.
Now, like you referred to vertical shoring, for our listeners, what are some of the shores, or what would they consist of for somebody who's not real familiar with the USAR background?
Usually three post dead shores, timber shores. I know a lot of the paratex were put in place at first. The paratex struts went in place, and the idea behind a paratex is you take a header and a sole plate with you, put the paratex up, and you want to replace the paratex struts with wood so that the wood can stay. You can take the paratex down, and you now have created a safe haven with the wood struts, and you can move further into the collapsed area with the paratex, put them up temporarily and build around them and take them down. So you can just keep moving on and making your way in.
So it's definitely having that advanced technology of the manufactured trucks accelerates our ability to gain access.
Certainly does.
But like everything in life, if it provides a service, it also provides a cost of service.
Yeah, that's more the reason not leaving the paratex. You're talking areas of $15,000 to $20,000 worth of paratex struts. You can't leave things like that. It's just, you know, you just can't afford to do that. Whereas you can put the struts in place temporarily to build a three-post vertical around it, take the struts down, move further into the collapse, and you can just keep kind of leapfrogging with the struts as you go.
And with that, as you're referring to, the paratex allows us to move quickly, but now we see where we're utilizing more manpower, more labor, more knowledge for that second wave who comes in and basically does shore replacement. Mm-hmm. They'll come in now with dimensional timbers and lumber and replace the paratex so you can remove them, move them forward, or put them back into the storage component of your cache. The other thing I don't think a lot of times the general population sees is an incident like this. Once we shore it, the shoring stays. It's not like at the end we disassemble it and
right.
we leave, because obviously we have no clue what the impact of removing that shoring may have on the structure, obviously an additional collapse.
Well, the downside is there's really only one true way to test your shoring. And you load it. And if it loads and it holds, great. But that's all the more reason why you can't take that and remove it, because you don't know what the building has done in that time parameter, even that operational period that you've been working. You just don't know.
You know, and that goes back to, you know, resources. Fortunately, in the States, when we have deployments, we were very fortunate to have a lot of the big box stores or preset caches. Many of the teams will have flatbed tractor trailers full of lumber as a single part of their resource. With Task Force 1 in New Jersey, what type of volume of resources do you bring to an event of this type? As far as the lumber, I mean the magnitude.
We have a training cache of lumber, and we have a deployment cache that's on a flatbed, just as you suggested. We'll bring 4x4s, 6x6s, 2x4s, and 2x6s for vertical and upright bracing. We'll bring plywood for sheeting and bracing as well. So we've got a truckload of wood ready to go.
So, you know, everything you listed there, and they come anywhere from 12 to 16 foot in length,
yeah.
4x8 sheets. Going back into the fatigue factor, just moving that much material, getting it cut properly, getting it transported from a cutting location to an operational location or staged and then move in, we start to see how we really absorb volumes of members on scene. Now, with a team on a typical deployment, how many folks would you anticipate arriving on a first wave of the team deployment?
Well, if we deploy just one color, you're talking about roughly 70 to 75 people. And that's broken into all competencies, logistics, search, planning, rescue, medical, hazmat. All of them are coming. I think there's four rescue squads on each color. So now, if you're operating a cut station, in this case, I believe we were doing most of the work with 6x6. Now you're carrying 12 to 16 foot 6x6s. You have one squad specific for a cut station, and then you have a few runners bringing the material in. And you know, you need a few folks to carry a 6x, especially a 12 to 16 foot in length.
Yeah, so we start to see where we're absorbing our trained specialists very quickly. Everybody has a job. They're doing it well. Many times I've been in situations where you turn around, you look for somebody to help with something, and there are no bodies standing around waiting for a task. With this, you know, we start to see the value of having the local resources married up with the team or the UASI teams as New Jersey has their current operational capabilities. With this, if you know the shoring's in place, and unfortunately if there had been someone in there, which you know the positive side is there wasn't, the packaging begins, the patient removal begins. Sean, kind of just give us a brief overview of, we've now made patient contact. What would the medical and or rescue folks basically carry out, whether it's at a live operation or at a training scenario?
For removal of the patient, whether it be live or a training, it would be in a situation like this, is the medical component along with the rescue manager and the rescue group would get together and decide on how they were going to remove somebody. You know, in this case, in this collapse that we were in, I went to the rescue, who was the manager downstairs, and I said that if something happened, they had a RIT team there with a Stokes basket and a backboard, and they had it all rigged up at the top. There was a shaft that we were lifting and lowering all the wood and all the tools into, and I said that we would need to use a 4-to-1 vertical so we could lift somebody out. So there was a separate 4-to-1 setup just for the medical. Okay, we had it set on the side and the top, so if something happened, that was going to be set up just to pull somebody out of the hole. That was preset with myself and the rescue guys that were in the basement down there working and said, this is what we're going to do. If something happens, where we're going to go.
So a lot of good coordination.
Everything was coordinated. So if something did happen, the guys that were working were informed on what we were going to do. And then as the operation changed when we were doing the shoring downstairs and they brought in the other squads of guys, same thing. They were just said, when they're briefing, they said, if there's something happens to one of us or if we come upon a victim, this is how we're going to remove the victim and this is where we're going to go. So that was just, it would just be just another point. You would just step up, put the person in, and here we would go, and off they would be up and out of there.
So, a definite example of utilizing an incident command type of format where the multiple components are working together, communicating, establishing a agreed-upon operational strategy.
Absolutely.
Having the background of the medical team coming in, providing that extra information. The organizational capacity really makes a very difficult task look very easy to the outside viewer because it went smooth, everything's moving in a very clockwork type of manner. And that's what we're shooting for in the emergency services. The part I like to convey to our listeners at times is what you see taking place is really the product of many months or even years of practice, training, development of team concepts and procedures to get something like this accomplished. As we just kind of go through, it was good to have a quick session here at Firehouse Expo to touch on a very current affairs type of issue. With the buzz on technical rescue, we're looking to take advantage of the opportunity of having people of your background and knowledge, both Mike and Sean, as far as how we put our skills together, share the information with others. Both of these individuals very busy in their respective career fields. Sean on the emergency medical side and Mike on the fire service and rescue side. Both are very active here at Firehouse. You can find them at firehouse.com and in Firehouse Magazine, different things that they're participating with. So if you want to hear more from them in the future, just wanted to thank you both for taking some time out for the special session today while you're here, already very busy at the Expo. Any closing thoughts or comments on this incident or rescue as a whole? Sean?
One thing that was actually an added component that was made available to us at this particular incident was they have a thing in North Jersey now. It's called MD1 or MD2. It's a suburban-type vehicle that's run by a doctor, emergency room physician, trauma, sometimes some trauma docs also, and they bring out with them, besides just regular medical equipment like the paramedics have, they also have saws, that if we had to remove, if somebody was trapped and they had to take a limb off, they have the capability to have that. They also bring blood and blood products with them.
Wow.
So that if we had somebody and it was a long scale operation, we don't like to give, as we call it, the saline and the ringers that we give the fluid replacement, it's Kool-Aid. We don't want to make Kool-Aid out of the blood, so we actually have these doctors now that bring out these things, and they were there on scene with the rescue. background. One of the team doctors, Dr. Pruden, is a medical doctor, emergency room physician at St. Joe's Hospital in Patterson, and he had this truck there. So God forbid that some situation had happened in this basement with somebody, whether it be a rescuer or a civilian that was trapped, we would have had the added capability to take care of them.
Excellent. It shows, you know, multi-agency response and the communities, the emergency management component, having developed different types of resources.
Absolutely.
Here on the medical side, and very similar to what I've heard from other communities where they're bringing in what we would have 5-10 years ago in the fire service considered a non-traditional asset. 10 years ago, having a doctor on scene with a response vehicle fully equipped for that component of a special response, it was just in the conceptual and the thought process.
It was. You're totally right about that, Bob. Absolutely, it was just brand new. It's, you know, it's like recent. It's just started being used in the field.
And, you know, valuable resource. Mike, thoughts from you?
You know, just on resources, I've always said that being a member of Task Force One, we've got some of the best trained people in the field of technical rescue in the state, if not in the nation. We've got great leadership, great logistical support. Everybody on the team brings 110% of their skills to the table, and it definitely shows every time we go out. And it's not something that happens overnight. There's a lot of training behind the scenes, like you said, that a lot of people don't see. All year long, there's different components down at Lakehurst doing all their training, and the end result is what you see. Nobody got hurt. We all operated safely. Everybody went home, and that's most important.
Most definitely. I think it's a perfect way to wrap it up is everybody went home. It was a safe operation. We're working in very dynamic conditions, very challenging conditions, obviously. For a team of your magnitude to be activated, something significantly wrong has taken place, be it man-made or natural disaster. Now you're put in there to mitigate it, to step forward, and you're basically the last layer of capabilities. I want to thank you both today, Mike, Sean, for taking the time, for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the show today. Please listen to The Buzz on Technical Rescue on firehouse.com. And for those that are here at Firehouse Expo this week, please enjoy the classes. It's the largest volume of classes ever assembled for the participants here coming to the show. So thanks again, and be safe.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thank you very much.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website, www.firehouse.com/radio.